From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, better living through chemistry. Perhaps no industrial compound more fully represented that slogan than CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, as Seth Kagan and Philip Dre point out in their new book. But the miracle compound of the 20s, which made possible air conditioning and refrigeration, has also been destroying the ozone layer. We'll talk with Kagan and Dre about the rise and fall of CFCs. Also today, producer Amy Sallet talks with country rocker Joe Ely. He's been called the underappreciated American rock and roll legend. And book critic John Leonard reviews Drums Along the Congo, the new book by travel writer Rory Nugent, who also wrote The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that the so-called safe haven plan to protect Bosnian Muslims will not keep the United States from taking stronger action later on. Christopher said the plan would try to minimize the killing, increase pressure on the Bosnian Serbs, and contain the conflict in Bosnia. Bosnia's ambassador to the United Nations denounced the plan today, calling it a cover for non-action on the part of the Allies. An Oregon-based timber company has been fined $11.1 million for environmental crimes allegedly committed at plants across the United States. The Clinton administration says it's the start of a crackdown on companies that break environmental laws. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Louisiana Pacific, a timber company based in Portland, Oregon, was accused of lying on its permits and polluting the air near 15 plants that produced a type of composite wood. Today, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Carol Browner announced that the firm had agreed to pay the largest civil fine ever levied in connection with the Clean Air Act. Louisiana Pacific also agreed to install $70 million worth of experimental air pollution control equipment on its smokestacks. Company President Harry Merlo said he thought the fine was too large, but promised to get the new air pollution control technology in place as fast as possible. Browner said she expects to see more fines like this one in the years ahead as EPA and the Department of Justice crack down on corporate environmental crime. EPA critics said the promise would be hard to keep if EPA budget cuts go through. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court let stand a ruling that could force the Virginia Military Institute to admit women into the state-supported school. The court rejected VMI's argument that its male-only admission policy is constitutional because it promotes educational diversity. Rick Mattioni of member station WVTF in Roanoke reports.
VMI officials are disappointed with the decision because there was hope the justices would actually hear the case. Now proceedings will likely return to Roanoke Federal Court, where Judge Jackson Kaiser 2 years ago ruled in favor of the school. A federal appeals court last year decided that VMI could receive state money only if it admits women or if the state offers women similar training elsewhere. VMI spokesman Mike Strickler says the third option, for VMI to go private, is unlikely because the school could not make up the loss in state funding. VMI, which has nearly 1,300 cadets, receives $6.5 million a year from the state. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Mantioni in Roanoke, Virginia.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 15 points to close at 3,508. This is NPR. The Senate has confirmed San Francisco Supervisor Roberta Achtenberg as Assistant Secretary in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Achtenberg is an attorney and lesbian activist whose confirmation was strongly opposed by conservative Republicans led by Senator Jesse Helms. He was angry about her efforts to cut United Way funding to the Boy Scouts because they won't allow homosexuals to serve as scout leaders. Supporters said that Achtenberg was well qualified to run HUD's Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity and that critics were opposing her solely because of her sexual orientation. Achtenberg was confirmed on a vote of 58-31. Four Israeli soldiers were killed and three injured by friendly fire in South Lebanon today. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more.
The incident occurred before dawn when two groups of Israeli paratroopers were on initiated actions in the area Israel calls its security zone in South Lebanon. The details are still unclear, but one group of soldiers apparently mistook the other group for Arab guerrillas. The chief of staff appointed a high-level commission of inquiry into the incident. The head of Northern Command said initiated actions would continue in South Lebanon despite today's incident. Recently, there have been several serious accidents in the Army. In one case last November, Israeli soldiers fired a missile at other soldiers at a training base in the Negev Desert, killing five. Several senior officers, including the chief of staff, narrowly escaped injury. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The United Mine Workers Union said today that it's expanding a strike now underway against coal companies in three states. Union officials said that 2,200 miners in West Virginia and Pennsylvania are being asked to join the walkout. There are already 4,000 miners on the picket lines in Indiana, Illinois, and West Virginia. The union claims that the Coal Operators Association is denying job security to union members when mines are closed down. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The scientific miracle of today can become the environmental hazard of tomorrow. We saw that happen with CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. The invention of CFCs in 1928 made possible safe refrigeration and air conditioning. CFCs were essential to the development of aerosol sprays and styrofoam. Unfortunately, we learned in the 70s that CFCs were also destroying the ozone layer of the stratosphere. My guests have used the story of CFCs as a parable of modern industrial times. Philip Dre and Seth Kagan are the authors of Between Earth and Sky, How CFCs Changed Our World and Endangered the Ozone Layer. They previously collaborated on a book about the murders of civil rights workers Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney in Mississippi. When CFCs were invented, they were known as the miracle compound. Philip Dre told me why they were so miraculous.
They were considered a miracle because all the refrigerants then in use were considered dangerous. They were either flammable or toxic or both, and there had been several fatal accidents. So as the household refrigeration business was beginning to take off, industrialists like those at General Motors saw a need for a new kind of refrigerant that would be stable, chemically stable and safe. And CFCs were the answer to that search.
And how did CFCs then change America?
CFCs turned out to be more capable than even its inventors had imagined in terms of its versatility as a compound. First, CFCs were used in refrigeration, but a very quick realization was that they could also work as a refrigerant in air conditioning. And the whole air conditioning industry took off after CFCs were first synthesized. Then it was discovered that they worked really well in aerosol sprays to disperse things like pesticides and hairspray, and so an entire industry of aerosols took off. And after that, it was discovered that they worked to make insulating foams like styrofoam and as a solvent in the electronics manufacturing industry. So by the 1970s, CFCs were everywhere.
This isn't the story of, the chemical industry being sneaky in getting us to use a chemical that they knew was dangerous. I mean, people really believe that CFCs were the safe alternative to dangerous coolants.
Well, yes, that's right. In fact, when CFCs were first introduced in the early 1930s, the same people who invented it, the engineers at General Motors, had also produced leaded gasoline, ethyl, in the mid-20s, and there had been a scare about that, which was really a very interesting story. They called it the Looney Gas Scandal, and there was a threat that the industry would be shut down, which DuPont and General Motors successfully resisted. But later, when CFCs were introduced, the companies did put the chemical through very thorough testing for flammability and toxicity. Ironically, the ozone layer was only just being discovered about that time, so nobody could have possibly linked those two things together.
Well, it's interesting that the scientist who discovered CFCs in 1928 also came up with the idea of leaded gas. And that's another example of something that was thought to be real great at the time and then became a real environmental problem decades afterwards.
Only health cranks objected to leaded gas. It was like, these people who thought there was a problem with putting leaded gas were just stereotyped as hysterics and do-gooders. And the juggernaut of industry, the idea that faster, more efficient car engines were a good thing, was so universally accepted that to protest against it was almost futile.
And what did lead in gas accomplish?
Well, lead and gas mostly allowed for faster acceleration, and it also worked. It made the carburetor work more efficiently so that larger motors could be built. So this fit perfectly with Detroit's vision of building larger, faster, more modern cars.
No, I think it wasn't until 1972 that some scientists started theorizing that CFCs could deplete the ozone level. How did they figure that out, and who were they?
Well, by the early 1970s, the whole notion that the chemistry of the atmosphere was important was not very widely accepted. Most people who studied the atmosphere were meteorologists, who were concerned with air movements and clouds and weather and so forth. And the idea that chemicals in the atmosphere had any importance was not thought about much. But there was a scientist at the University of California at Irvine named F. Sherwood Rowland, who was an atmospheric chemist. And he learned at a scientific meeting that CFCs had been measured in the atmosphere. An instrument had been invented capable of detecting them, even though they are only in very minute quantities. And being a chemist interested in the atmosphere, he asked what now seems like an obvious question. Well, what happens to them if they're in the atmosphere? And after he asked that question and began to look into it, it wasn't too long before he discovered what is now known as the ozone depletion theory.
How did he discover it?
Well, he worked with a postdoctorate student named Mario Molina, and the sequence was that first the two of them, as atmospheric chemists, had to ask where could CFCs go once they're in the atmosphere. And they were able to rule out a lot of things. CFCs are not absorbed by plants. They're not absorbed in the oceans. They're not washed out by rain. Nothing breaks them down in the lower atmosphere. That is, the molecules stay intact. What they realized, though, is that eventually CFCs would drift higher and higher in the atmosphere until they reached the stratosphere, at which point they would, in fact, come into contact with something that breaks them apart, and that something is ultraviolet radiation. Once the CFCs are broken apart by ultraviolet radiation, one of the molecules that's produced, one of the atoms that is produced, is chlorine. And they, being chemists, recognized that chlorine was very, very reactive with ozone. And once the chlorine reacts with the ozone, it actually depletes the ozone. And at that point, they realized that there was a serious environmental problem associated with CFCs.
So back in 1972, when these scientists figured that out, it was still a theory. Did they have the equipment to actually measure the effect on the ozone then?
Well, this at first, their work was theoretical. But then people who did high-altitude balloon testing began attempting to measure various aspects of what was known as the Rowland-Molina theory. And they would try to measure that CFCs were present in the stratosphere, try to measure various incidents of ozone depletion. This was actually a very important issue because industry, when it was assailed by the Rowland-Molina theory, began insisting that definite physical proof be given of ozone depletion before they would agree to start phasing down the manufacture of CFCs. And this became part of what was ultimately a 13-year battle between scientists, environmentalists, government regulators, and industry to get to the point in 1987 when the Montreal Protocol was signed, agreeing to phase out the manufacture of CFCs.
Let me get back to the research that Rowland and Molina did, you know, hypothesizing that CFCs would deplete the ozone layer. They published their first big article on the subject in 1972 in Nature magazine. What was the reaction to the article?
When Rowland and Molina first published the theory that their theory that CFCs deplete ozone, they anticipated that there would be a great reaction because this was startling, shocking news. They were horrified by the implications of what they'd learned because without ozone in the stratosphere, all sorts of adverse environmental impacts would happen on the surface of the Earth. But in fact, when the article first was published, there was very little response to it because scientific journals, being what they are not widely read or widely understood. And the people who read the journal and understood the article were equally horrified, many of them as Rowland and Molina, but it didn't really become a public issue at that point.
Also, one thing I was going to just throw in was that among the public and even some scientists, the whole concept of ozone chemistry or atmospheric chemistry was at that time so confusing. Many people didn't really even know what the ozone layer was. And so that was another reason why Rowland and Molina's announcement really seemed to fall on deaf ears.
Well, for those of us still a little confused about what the ozone layer is, maybe this would be a good time to get you to explain it.
Well, ozone is a naturally occurring chemical in the stratosphere. It's continually being formed and destroyed by natural processes. It's a form of oxygen. And ozone exists in the stratosphere naturally, and In the stratosphere, what it does is it filters out ultraviolet radiation and prevents the radiation from reaching the surface of the Earth. When ozone is depleted by man-made chemicals like CFCs, it allows more ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface of the Earth, and that's what causes the environmental problem.
So what are the dangers with the depletion of the ozone layer?
The most famous risk is of skin cancer. When people first theorized that ozone depletion was a problem, that's what they said. They said, we're going to have a greater incidence of skin cancer. There are many other impacts as well. It causes cataracts. It can impair immune efficiency in human beings. It interferes with photosynthesis. It creates ozone. It actually creates smog at ground level. So there's a whole host of environmental ills associated with ozone depletion.
What was the reaction within the chemical industry to the theory that CFCs were depleting the ozone layer?
Well, at first, they reacted with a great deal of hostility. The largest maker of CFCs was the DuPont Corporation, and of course they had also been involved in helping to put lead into gasoline many years earlier. One thing we learned about DuPont while writing Between Earth and Sky was that they had become conditioned after about a century and a half of manufacturing dangerous things to public outcries of various kinds that their products were dangerous or harmful. And so when the CFC problem first arose, their reaction was a kind of a conditioned one of, well, this is just one more thing that we're going to have to, you know, take care of and silence. So they went about it in various ways, chiefly trying to discredit Dr. Rowland and Mario Molina, and also trying to bring in their own studies and their own experts who would contradict the Rowland-Molina theory.
My guests are writers Seth Kagan and Philip Dre. They're the authors of the new book, Between Earth and Sky, How CFCs Changed Our World and Endangered the Ozone Layer. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Seth Kagan and Philip Dre, authors of a new book about CFCs and how they've changed our world. Take us to the 1980s when the ozone hole in Antarctica was discovered. How was it discovered?
That's really a very interesting story. The measurement of ozone from the ground is something that began only in the late 1920s. It's always been considered a quiet corner of science, not known for being particularly interesting. There was a man named Joseph Farman from the British Antarctic Survey who had, however, operated an ozone measuring device at Antarctica since 1957. In the early 1980s, he began noticing that the seasonal levels were quite low, and he at first assumed his instrument had malfunctioned. The following year, he replaced it with a new instrument. When that reported the same low readings, he assumed that there was some sort of electromagnetic interference from the sun, perhaps. It wasn't until the third year that he began to really become concerned that these readings were accurate. One reason that he hesitated also was that the NASA satellite that also measured the same region of the world, its computers were set to disregard data that was that low as being in error, so that the ozone hole was occurring, and yet no one was really able to identify it. When Farman did finally come forward in 1985 with the news, it really caught everyone by surprise because that type of depletion had not been predicted by anyone's computer models to take place until perhaps another 100 or 150 years. The fact that it was occurring already was alarming, to say the least.
Do you give the chemical industry any credit for taking the initiative in cutting down on the production of CFCs, or do you think it was all because of either government or public pressure?
We learned that the chemical industry is actually very proud of what it did to curtail the manufacture of CFCs. If you were to talk to representatives of the chemical industry, they would absolutely dispute the idea that they resisted or were slow in taking any steps. And in a sense, you have to have some sympathy for them because the ozone depletion theory was only put forward in the early 1970s. By the mid to late 1980s, there had already been agreements to stop their manufacture, to curtail their manufacture. It's not really a terribly long time when you consider how slow science works and how slow diplomacy works and government regulation. And the chemical industry would argue that they actually funded a lot of the research that ultimately proved that CFCs were hazardous and that they were very aggressive. I think that the true record is a little bit more mixed than that, because there were times when they did not seem terribly interested in learning the bad news about CFCs.
Where do we stand now on the production of CFCs? There was the Montreal Protocol in 1986 that I think was, 57 countries signed?
Correct.
What standard are we being held to now by the Montreal Protocol?
Well, the Montreal Protocol was updated in London in 1992 and has since been revisited again. One of the ingenious features of the protocol, which is the first international treaty ever to address a global environmental problem, one of its innovative features was that as science better understood the scope of the problem, the signatories to the treaty agreed to meet and revise regulations as needed. And unfortunately for the world, ozone depletion has continuously been worse than predicted. Scientific expectations as to how bad it was going to be have been exceeded time and again by reality. So that's why the signatories to the Montreal Protocol have met several times to hasten the pace of cutting back on CFC manufacture and use.
What is it still legal to use CFCs in?
Well, it's legal to use them in anything. What's been restricted is the quantity that can be manufactured, and the market decides how they'll be used. With the exception of aerosols, they're not legal in aerosols in this country. But each signatory to the agreement can restrict them however they want, as long as they ratchet down the quantity they manufacture and reach certain levels by certain goals. I believe that the latest is that there should be no more manufacture of CFCs by the year 2000.
Well, what about my car air conditioning, my room air conditioner at home, and my refrigerator? Do they all still have CFCs, do you think?
Yes, they do right now. DuPont and other chemical manufacturers are working on alternatives. That in itself is a matter of some controversy, just in that the two most likely alternatives found so far are not perfect. They either also contribute to ozone depletion or contribute to global warming by virtue of the fact that they aren't as efficient as CFCs, so they use more energy. So what is happening now to a certain extent in ozone politics is that industry is trying to secure guarantees from the government to be able to manufacture these specific alternatives to a certain date, say 2035. The government is only interested in allowing them to do so till, say, the year 2015. So this type of disagreement would characterize the regulatory scene right now.
So it's important to stress that as zealous as we may feel about eliminating CFCs to help the ozone layer, if we eliminated them right now, we wouldn't have air conditioners or refrigerators that work.
We wouldn't have them that work, and it's also important to realize that all our existing refrigerators and air conditioners have CFCs in them. And those CFCs are eventually going to enter the atmosphere and are eventually going to deplete ozone. So, you know, that refrigerator at home, when it's junked, is going to contribute to ozone depletion.
Is there a way to recycle CFCs?
That's one of the goals, to recycle CFCs, and there are technologies to do that now. But even if you recycle them, eventually there's going to come a time when the CFC enters the atmosphere, reaches the stratosphere, and depletes ozone.
Right. CFCs can linger in the atmosphere for as long as 150 years. So we have, even though the phase-out will hopefully take place, there will still be a long time of rising levels of CFCs in the atmosphere before eventually they're gone and the ozone layer can restore itself.
Do you have a favorite story from the writing of the book?
I think my favorite story concerns a Swiss professor named Auguste Piccard, who was the first man to visit the stratosphere in 1930. At the time, it was considered a totally insane thing to do. He put together a balloon and a gondola that was the first balloon gondola made of metal. It was not like previously they had used wicker baskets. And he also designed his own kind of crash helmet, which was these wicker baskets piled on top of one another and then strapped around his chin. And everybody laughed at him. But nonetheless, he went up in this balloon, and they thought he was dead. And there was an article on the front page of the New York Times saying he was a goner. But the next morning, he came down in the Alps, and he had been up to 51,000 feet. So he was in the stratosphere, and he then became a worldwide celebrity, going everywhere describing how beautiful the Earth looked from up there.
I think my favorite story from the book has to do with the demise of Thomas Midgley. He was, as we know, a great inventor, and in his later years, he was struck by polio, which was very rare for a person at his age. I think he was in his 50s.
Let me just stop you and remind our listeners that Midgley was a scientist who invented CFCs and leaded gasoline.
That's right. And he developed polio. One of his hobbies was grass. He had an incredible lawn that had pesticide running through the sprinkler systems so that he could take care of bugs when they came up. But one of his last inventions, because he had polio, was of a harnessing device that he could use to get himself in and out of bed without having to ask his nurse or his wife to help him. And he became very despondent at the end of his life, probably because of the polio, and he used his own invention to kill himself. And ironies there always struck me as kind of rich.
Did Midgley live long enough to find out the dangers of CFCs and of leaded gasoline?
Not of CFCs, although, of course, he was involved in the mid-1920s trying to restore the reputation of leaded gasoline, and he did this by traveling to New York and in front of a room full of reporters swallowing some of the tetraethyl lead to show that it wasn't harmful. This was the way, that was his favorite way of debunking fears about anything he invented. He also did that with CFCs. He would inhale the CFCs and then blow out a candle to show in one gesture that they were neither toxic or flammable.
Of course, he did suffer from lead poisoning. He didn't bother to tell the reporters.
No, he kept that to himself.
How long did it take him to get the lead poisoning?
Well, he got it in the course of working to find TEL, leaded gasoline. He worked on that project for many, many years. And after he had discovered lead in gasoline, or that lead would work as an additive in gasoline, and realized he had lead poisoning, he went to Florida to recuperate. So it wasn't terrible for him, although many of the workers who manufactured tetraethyl lead died in the course of manufacturing it. That's what caused the big scandal surrounding the product.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the kind of scary conclusions of your book is that sometimes things have consequences, and we're just not going to know about it until several decades after the problems have started. I mean, like with CFCs, like we were saying, people, no one really knew that it would hurt the ozone layer. It's not that scientists were being negligent or deceitful. So who knows about the stuff we're using now and what problems that's going to cause in the future?
Well, that has to do with the pace of technological progress. We invent things so quickly, and then when new products or new technologies are invented, they can be mass produced so quickly and proliferate around the globe so that the problem can be enormous before anyone even dreams of what potential problems it might present. And it's kind of related to the whole juggernaut of progress and the fact that technologies are huge and populations are huge. So it's very that is a philosophical question at the core of our book, which is that sometimes technologies race ahead of our scientific understanding of their impacts.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Seth Kagan and Philip Dre are the authors of the new book Between Earth and Sky, How CFCs Changed Our World and Endangered the Ozone Layer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, country rocker Joe Ely. Ely's been performing for about 20 years and has just released his 10th album, Love and Danger. One reviewer writes about Ely's music, it's got the dynamic locomotion of rock, the righteous sassiness of blues, the narrative twang of country, and the hook-filled melodic sheen of pop. And book critic John Leonard reviews Drums Along the Congo, the new book about traveling in Africa by Rory Nugent. Leonard was a fan of Nugent's previous book, The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck, about traveling in Asia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The Senate voted today to confirm Roberta Achtenberg as the nation's top fair housing official, making her the first acknowledged lesbian to hold a senior-level government post. The vote was 58-31. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Achtenberg is a former San Francisco County supervisor who now takes over the job of Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Conservative Republicans opposed her nomination for two reasons: as a director of the Bay Area United Way, she had voted to deny funding to the Boy Scouts, and because of her sexual orientation. North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms called Achtenberg a militantly activist lesbian. Michigan Democrat Don Riegel spoke for Achtenberg's nomination.
Clearly, by any objective standard, Roberta Achtenberg is extraordinarily well qualified by her training and substantive professional experience. I believe her sexual orientation has no place in the debate over her nomination.
Riegel said arguments against Achtenberg's nomination amounted to a smokescreen. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
A UN refugee aid official says the Western allies' plan to confine embattled Muslims in safe areas in Bosnia would be a catastrophe. The plan has drawn similar criticism from American members of Congress and from the president of Bosnia. The UN envoy, Jose Maria Mendeluz, says the Muslims could be trapped for years with little more to meet their needs than food. He adds that the world would soon forget about them. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade reports that in one of the towns where the safe area plan is already in effect, it has been only minimally successful.
Certainly from what we've been hearing here, the situation in one of them, in Srebrenica, in eastern Bosnia, is very bad. There's a tremendous breakdown in law and order. There's a lot of theft. There's a black market. There's apparently the currency is cigarettes, Western cigarettes. There's prostitution. There's not much else. And the UNHCR officials say, you know, that the international community should really look to the case of Srebrenica because it could set it could be a model in a negative sense of other safe havens if the UN is simply set on the perimeter to protect them without providing some kind of infrastructure and a recreation of a social structure in these places.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade. Defending the allies' plan, Secretary of State Warren Christopher has said the policy will not deter the U.S. from taking further action to help the Muslims. The Khmer Rouge has surprised some observers by allowing people in some of its territories to vote in the Cambodian elections. Khmer Rouge guerrillas had threatened to disrupt the elections for a democratic government, but millions of voters have ignored death threats to cast ballots. The voting ends on Friday. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials gained almost 15 points. This is NPR. United Nations researchers say they have not found a single country that treats its women as well as its men. The findings are part of the 1993 UN Human Development Report. The report says women often earn half the salary of men and also face discrimination in healthcare, nutrition, education, and politics. The United States dropped from 6th to 9th place in the UN's quality of life rankings because of its treatment of women. Three industrial groups who have been vying to design the next generation of television laid aside their differences today and announced they have agreed on a standard approach. The companies hope the agreement will hasten the day when people can buy televisions with pictures as clear as you see in the movie theater. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The high-stakes fight over who would define the next generation of American televisions ended in a draw that will benefit many leading manufacturers, big names including RCA, Sylvania, Magnavox, AT&T, and Zenith. The compromise they came to was over the technical details of future TVs and broadcasting equipment, just as light bulb manufacturers long ago agreed on a standard socket. These new standards will mean a revolution in TVs, including crystal clear pictures and CD quality sound. It's called high-definition TV. The FCC will now test the proposed technology to see if it's suitable. If it is, the manufacturers hope to have the new TVs on the market in 3 years. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The government is fining a wood products company more than $11 million for creating excessive pollution and giving false information about it to officials. The Environmental Protection Agency and the Justice Department say the fine against Louisiana Pacific is the second largest civil penalty ever under federal environmental laws. EPA says the company will reduce its emissions by 90% to 95% by installing state-of-the-art equipment in its plants. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Country rocker Joe Ely is from Lubbock, Texas, the town that also produced Buddy Holly and Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. So we asked Amy to talk with Ely about his music and their hometown. While Ely was still living in Lubbock, he formed the group The Flatlanders, which Rolling Stone magazine has called more of a legend than a band. It featured Ely, the now semi-famous Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and Butch Hancock. In Country Music Magazine, Ely was described as Texas's real gift to popular music, a gift that the rest of the world has never known quite what to do with. Though he's revered like a god in his home state, Ely's usually relegated to playing small clubs when he ventures further afield. From his latest album, Love and Danger, this is Love is the Beating of Hearts.
Hearts tell you things words can't say. Darkness, our light of day. As far as I can discern, love asks for love in return.
Some critics have written that this new album, Love and Danger, is somewhat of a departure for you, and there are more tender ballads and love songs that speak about a more settled kind of love. What do you think?
I think they're right, yeah.
Can you talk about this new place in your life, where you're at, that it represents?
I think it represents, for one thing, that I'm not, I can't really say that. I'm on the road now. But I'm not like just living on the road. I'm taking time out for myself and going out into the desert and doing a whole bunch of different things instead of just like living, breathing in a band, living in motels, you know, truck stops. And I've kind of felt like I was all constantly on the road.
And let's talk about Lubbock, Texas. We're both from Lubbock, but probably most of the people listening now have never been there. So when you're talking to people, how do you describe Lubbock?
It's an island. It's surrounded by cotton instead of water. It's hard weather. It's hard climate. It's dusty. The people that settled it were tough, probably about half out of their minds. But it's got great dirt and great sky. And so it became kind of a mecca for cotton farmers because it had this great, really great dirt, a lot of sun.
Well, no, you didn't mention how flat it is.
Oh, I didn't say how flat it was.
You didn't say flat.
I guess I've said that so much that I forget.
It's flat.
Oh, it's very flat. I always laugh at my Uncle J.B. He had a cotton farm outside of Lubbock, and there was this little Chinese elm tree that was about a half a mile from his house out the window, and it was the only thing that obstructed the entire horizon line. And for every time we'd go there a couple of years, he'd always gripe about that tree, and then we came one Christmas, and JB had cut that tree down because it had interfered with the perfectness of the flatness of the horizon.
How did you first get interested in rock and roll?
When I first moved from Amarillo to Lubbock, I was in the fifth grade, and a guy down the street by the name of Bob Blassingame had a Fender guitar with a amplifier that had reverb on it. And I'd been playing the violin in Amarillo, and when I heard that guitar, there was something about it that sounded like the wind or something, you know. I knew that was the right sound, you know, more than the violin. And also, I guess only in that part of the country could this happen. A guy came around door to door with a steel guitar in one hand and an amplifier in the other, selling steel guitar lessons. And my mother invited him in, and he sat up over in the corner of the living room and played Hawaiian music. And it was so strange to hear Hawaiian music looking out with kind of a barren landscape and dust in the air that I started taking steel guitar lessons.
From him?
Yeah.
So he would come to your house once a week?
No, he had a place downtown called the Dunnigan School of Music. Found out years later that Buddy Holly had taken steel guitar lessons from him and had also lived in the house where Bob had the Fender guitar.
So when did you start? Did you start playing clubs? When did you start playing more professionally around there?
Only when I left there. I left Lubbock and went down to Dallas and Fort Worth and started playing the old Cellar Club. You know, really kind of see what it was like to be a musician night after night and play. Like this one place would play alternate sets with what later became ZZ Top. Would play an hour, and they'd play an hour, and we'd play an hour from 6 in the evening till 6 in the morning. That didn't last very long, but a couple of months, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that period of your life, because at some point you went out to California with your guitar, right? And were you seeking fame and fortune? What did you think would happen?
No, I the first time I went to California with my guitar was when this guy, Bad Bob, who ran the Cellar Club, pulled a gun on me, and I hightailed it out of Houston. I'd found out that they were keeping blacks out of the club by pointing up at a $99 cover charge thing above the door, and it really didn't settle with me because I'd lived in downtown Houston and got to know a lot of the guys around that area. And so I told Bob I was quitting, and he pulls a gun, and I say, give me a count of 10, and I hightailed it out of there, went straight to California, had enough money held back to buy a ticket in Houston, straight to L.A. I didn't have a guitar with me, but I had my amplifier. They let me put it on the seat in the plane, and I carried it out to Venice Beach from the airport and slept on it that night and stayed out there about 6 months and found an old acoustic guitar. And that was really when I started making up songs and or more making up songs on my own instead of something that I thought a band would be playing. And so that was a kind of a, although it was a strange kind of period and real unsettling, I'd all of a sudden jumped to another state, completely separated from any kind of roots that I had. But it was a time that, you know, I've learned a lot, you know, found out a lot about myself and about survival. And a lot of songs kind of came out of that. You know, I don't know if there's anything I ever kept, but a lot of them, it was a good time to... Things started boiling then, you know.
So why'd you leave California?
I didn't. It was real exciting and all, but I didn't really feel like I fit in. I wanted to get back to Texas, and I guess it was good that I did because that's where I met Jimmy and Butch, and that was where we started. I guess with the Flatlanders when we were all playing our own songs, night after night, mainly in the living room of the house that we shared together. But we were, you know, putting our own songs together and playing them.
I want to play something by the Flatlanders. There's only one Flatlanders album. It was recorded in 1971, but at that time it only came out on 8-track tape. A few years ago, Rounder Records reissued it on CD. So let's listen to this Jimmy Dale Gilmore song called Dallas. Listen for the saw.
Did you ever see Dallas from a BC 9 at night? Well, Dallas is a jewel. Oh, yeah, Dallas is a beautiful sight. And Dallas is a jungle, but Dallas gives a beautiful light. Did you ever see Dallas from a BC 9 at night? Well, Dallas is a woman. Walk on you when you're down, but when you are up, she's the kind you wanna take around. But Dallas ain't a woman to help you get your feet on the ground.
That was the Flatlanders featuring my guest Joe Ely on guitar. We're gonna take a short break now. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Ely. Now, at some point in all of this, you join the circus. I've lost track of the chronology.
But yeah, I have too.
Why did you join the circus?
I didn't mean to. It was completely by accident. I saw him setting up the circus on the parking lot at Texas Tech, and I just asked this guy who looked like he was in charge, just completely out of curiosity, what it would take for somebody to join the circus. And he kind of looks me over and hands me a sledgehammer and says, take off your shirt and start driving stakes. And so I took it as kind of like divine guidance or something. So I joined the circus right then and there. And
how old were you then?
This was after the Flatlanders, so I was probably 25, 26. And I thought, well, I've done everything else. I'll travel around with the circus. So I traveled around all the stops in Texas, New Mexico, and Oklahoma until I was kicked by a horse and decided that wasn't for me.
So well, other than getting kicked by the horse, what was it like to realize this classic dream of running off and joining the circus?
It's pretty miserable, really. It's more romantic sounding than it really was. We had, you know, it was the middle of summer in Texas. We played El Paso and Albuquerque, and it was 100 degrees and sweaty, and we rode on the trains in a little tiny compartment at the end of the animal cars. I took care of the llamas and the world's smallest horse, and the llamas had spit at me, and the horse would try to bite my kneecap, and you know, it was just terrible. But
is that what you did?
It was romance, you know, pure romance. I had fallen kind of secretly in love with this tall Bulgarian girl that did three flips off her brother's shoulders and landed on the back of a horse that was running around in circles. And that's what got me kicked. I wasn't paying attention to what I was doing, but it kicked some sense into me and showed me that I really needed to be making music and not feeding llamas.
So you didn't perform? Did you get to perform at all?
Oh, no, come on. But I got to be good friends with Michu, who was the world's smallest man, and showed Michu Amarella in the hospital where I was born.
How tall was he?
He was just not quite as tall as the world's smallest horse.
Did he ride the world's
smallest? No, he didn't. But he showed me his room. It was really amazing. everything was really small, like a really little small Barca lounger over in the corner, and little bitty, you know, 5-inch TV, and
Is he still around? Are you in touch?
Haven't seen him. The next year, they found the world's smallest woman for him, and they had the world's biggest wedding in the center ring of the big top, and it was the perfect P.T. Barnum extravaganza.
Did you go?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I did. I wouldn't miss it for anything.
So now you're living in Austin, and so many musicians move there, and, you know, there are a lot of clubs, there's a lot of music there. Do you think it's a healthy place for you to live, or do you tend to stagnate there? Which is it?
People have always wondered why, because I'd made records with MCA in Nashville and L.A., why I didn't move to one of those cities, which is probably, if I had been logical, that's probably the logical place to have moved, and I'd have probably had more songs on soundtracks if I'd have done that. But Texas has something that those places don't have. You know, it's got space, it's got lots of open air, it's got big sky, and that's more important to me than the whole music business thing.
Well, I think we're out of time, but yeah. Joe Ely, I really want to thank you for dropping by today.
Well, great to be here.
Joe Ely spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Ely's latest album is called Love and Danger. This is Sleepless in Love.
He had hair black as a fiberglass speedboat. Morning air as crisp as a brand new banknote. He swaggered like a surfer on a Louisiana dirt bike. He swerved like a trucker on a Dallas turnpike. They were sleepless in love. They were lovers. They were lovers. Sleepless in love.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is back after 3 weeks reporting from Serbia. Noah, welcome back. And tell us what's happening on All Things Considered.
Hi, Terry. It's good to be back, and it was great to be over there, by the way. Sylvie Pajoli reports tonight from Belgrade on reaction to the plan to provide safe havens for the Muslim population in Bosnia. And I'll talk with Bosnia's ambassador to the United Nations, Mohamed Chakrabe, who says it's a bad deal. The Bosnian government will not go along with this plan. It would be like putting the Muslims on Indian reservations. He also says it's time for Bosnia to ask other nations for help in fighting the Bosnian Serbs. Andy Bowers reports on the effect of television on public policy regarding Bosnia. And Bob Garfield goes looking for great barbecue in Memphis and finds it. The Russians have it.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck was Rory Nugent's book about his search for a very rare bird in India. Nugent's new book, Drums Along the Congo, was inspired by news reports of an attempt to find a Congo dinosaur. He sublet his apartment and sold whatever items wouldn't fit inside his Chevy Caprice. He parked the Chevy in his garage and took a plane to Africa. John Leonard says, Drums Along the Congo is another amazing adventure.
2 years ago, reviewing The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck, I said here that in Rory Nugent, America had at last produced a travel writer as crazy as the British. It says something about Nugent that he's permitted this remark to be quoted on the jacket of his new book. Otherwise, in Africa, this time instead of Asia, he doesn't say much about himself at all, except that he looks like a 6-foot-2-inch lollipop, wears boxer shorts, smokes camels, once upon a time ran a coastal blockade to deliver a boat to anti-Somoza forces in Nicaragua, and it took him 40 days and 40 nights in the Congo to get a permit letting him leave Brazzaville for the rainforest, in search this time for Mokolimembi, supreme deity of the jungle, a very long, thin-necked god-beast sauropod, the last living dinosaur, with blood-red eyes, rust-colored skin, short-napped fur, and a jumbo tusk, who hisses like a dragon, murmurs like a stream, and leaves behind in its mysterious vine-eating passage footprints the size of cheese wheels or frisbees. But we can intuit a lot about Nugent from what he notices. While he doesn't mind appearing absurd, he's more than the splendid quack I'd originally imagined. Besides a dreamer, he's also a moralist. The European land grab of Africa is much on his mind, and the 17 million human beings shipped off to slave markets, and the fact that more than half the Congo's rainforest has been okayed for logging because oil revenues are down. If the Congo's Marxist president likes wrestling so much that midget tag team matches occupy a third of the national TV schedule, well, he can't be any worse than King Leopold or empire builder Stanley or the French legionnaires and mercenaries who caused 60% of a conscripted black workforce to die building the Congo Railroad, 93 dead bodies for every mile of track. And how much has really changed when Nugent can leave the Brazzaville Fetish Museum to discover on the street a Chairman Mao tie tack? This, however, is to be too solemn. Most of Drums Along the Congo is delightful slapstick. In their river passage toward Lake Tilly, an equatorial leftover from before the Ice Age, Nugent and his government nanny and various witch doctor insect oracles and Bantu spear chuckers experience every travail of the mythic quest, and also lots of hallucinogenic scenery. At each village, they must pay a toll or tithe to the tribal chieftain, bottles of scotch and kilos of salt, after which a friendly goat is sacrificed. There is crow instead of rabbit in the Congo stew, and mouse birds up a tulip tree, and giant snails and poisonous frogs, and a lively trade in poached ivory and gorilla fingers, and Nugent is actually captured by a ragtag band of blowdart-toting pygmies. At one point, our hero in boxer shorts is eating monkey, and it occurs to him, as it certainly never would have occurred to me. In previous travels, I've dined on yak, camel, mongoose, dog, snake, rat, even crickets and worms, but I've never eaten this far up the evolutionary scale before. Miracles, too, wait in ambush. In such a rainforest, there ought to be dinosaurs. I'm persuaded, by the time you hear these words, I will have left for Africa myself. Really, I'm as serious as Nugent, who leaves behind in the imagination a dragon's hiss and footprints of the god-beast.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Drums Along the Congo by Rory Nugent. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Chilean writer Isabel Allende has written a new novel set in California, where she now lives. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about the surprising turns her life has taken since her uncle, Salvador Allende, was assassinated in a 1973 military coup. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.